Well, good morning. Welcome to hour number two, the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. When the new Congress gets down to work next year, there will be more women serving than currently. There'll be some new members joining the Senate and also the House, and that is good news for people who would like to see greater involvement of women in politics, that is in assuming electoral office. At the same time, for those people who say they believe that the Congress ought to be a more representative body than it is, they would say that the numbers of women in Congress are still disappointingly low, something like 16% of each chamber. In this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about women in politics, both running for office and also as voters, about how their political power in both respects, as candidates and as voters, does indeed continue to grow. And we'll talk specifically, I think, about the significance of women in the election that we just had. And our guest for the program is Susan Scher. She is someone who has been a political activist for a long time, something like 30 years or more than 30 years. Currently, she serves as the executive director of a group called the Women's Action for New Directions. It's based in Arlington, Massachusetts. She has done various kinds of work in different kinds of organizations, all really focused on this particular issue of women and their involvement in politics. She created and ran a program for women candidates at the Institute of Politics in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She has also managed campaigns and trained candidates and elected officials in their media kind of skills, their media presentation. She's also been a political commentator and a host on both radio and television shows in Massachusetts on a variety of topics, including everything from general politics to taxes. She also currently is president of the Ford Hall Forum, which is the longest-running public forum for the presentation of diverse discussion and debate. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome. Anybody who is listening is certainly welcome to jump into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, that number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And if you're listening in and around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening on the Internet, as a matter of fact, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Scher, hello.
Well, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, I'm very glad to, for many reasons, not the least of which is I'm originally from Indiana. So it's like old home week.
Who's your girl? All right. Very,
absolutely.
Very good. Very good. Well, just to start out, I guess I would want to acknowledge the fact that we will, as I said, in the new Congress and the one that will get down to business next year, we will have more women. So the number of women in Congress is going up. We will have some new members of the House and the Senate, new women members. So one would have to say, well, on the one hand, that's a good thing. We would like to have more women running for office. And as I said, if we really believe it's important for the body to be representative, 16% women, you know, that's really not very good. What could you say about the participation this time around in this last election of women, that is, in the respect of women running for office?
Well, more importantly, it was the women who were voting, and they were voting in record numbers this year and voting for women. Mm-hmm. And the women who were running for office felt that support very strongly. I mean, we can also say that the people who turned this election around were women, so the men are paying attention to it as well. It's very interesting because the term gender gap was actually coined in the 70s, and people have watched the progression of the gender gap over the years, but it has gone up and down. But during this election, the gender gap was so strong and so compelling, it makes women believe that now not only the elected officials but the voters have to pay attention to that fact, and it's going to make a very big difference in the presidential election in 2 years.
Yeah. Well, this is very interesting, and I know that I have read a number of things about the fact that this is the case, and I'm thinking that because perhaps it's been a while since people have heard that term. Maybe we better say what it is that means, because we haven't talked about gender gap in a while.
Oh, you're so right. You know, we use terms all the time. A lot of the work that my organization, WAN, does has to do with the federal budget, and we often talk about a blank check, and a new generation doesn't use checks. They use ATM cards, so they have no idea what we're talking about. But the gender gap really means that when either men or women are voting predominantly and making a difference, and the gender gap specifically pinpointed when women started voting in more numbers and making a difference on specific elections, or in general on many elections. In this election, it made a difference in every single seat that turned over. So, for example, one of the reasons why John Kerry did not win is because the number of women who voted and the number of women who voted for John Kerry was less than in previous presidential elections. Mm-hmm. So the gender gap did not work for him that year. This year, it's a watershed moment.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is marked differences in the voting patterns of men and women. It could be in terms of whether their tendency to vote for one party or one of the other major parties, or it could also be when you ask them what issues are most important to you. We also might see marked differences between men and women in terms of what they say is their number one issue, their number two issue, you know, so forth. What it is they consider to be important. And at certain times, there have been very big differences between men and women, and that could indeed make the difference. And as you say, it appears that in this last election, there were more women who voted for Democratic candidates than men, and that was very important. And there were some races, I know, particularly some in the Senate, where if you just took the women out, the Republican would have won. So the women made the difference between winning and losing for the Democrats, and the fact that so I think it's not an exaggeration to say that women voters are responsible for the fact that the control of both the House and the Senate has passed from the Republican Party to the Democrat.
Well, I don't think you can say that often enough, because what that also means is how are women in this country going to make their voices heard in the new Congress? Because since they were responsible for electing this new Congress, then we should have a say in how it's supposed to go. And let me just add, for those of your listeners who are thinking that all of these are Democratic women, one of the real warning bells was that Republican women felt so strongly against the war, or that the war needed to be fixed, handled, taken care of, over with, that also those Republican women were voting for change. So it was not just about more Democratic women voting, and it was not just about independent voters voting that way. So, of course, the first item up is Iraq. And are women going to specifically have a say in what happens? And whether or not women across the land are doing that is something that my organization will be working on. But also, and you mentioned this, Nancy Pelosi mm-hmm. will be Speaker of the House. And so all eyes will be watching her on how we treat Iraq.
I do think it's worth underscoring that point, that at least according to one survey that I've seen, a post-election survey, and this was the one that was done by Ms. Magazine, they found that if you asked men and women what their big concerns were, among women generally, their number one concern, they said, was the war in Iraq. And then, interestingly enough, as you say, if you then break this down according to their party affiliation, you ask Republican women what was their number one concern. It was the war in Iraq. For independents, it was not their number one concern. It was three of their top three, but they were all pretty close. And interestingly enough, among Democratic women, according to this survey, if you ask them what are their big concerns, it was health care, Social Security, and jobs and economic issues.
Well, let's a finer point on the jobs and economic issues is the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And the minimum wage has become the new economic issue. And I do think that the new Congress is going to stake a claim on the minimum wage. Republicans were looking at it even right before the election because they saw the writing on the wall. And more women favored the minimum wage than male voters, and all of the minimum wage ballot questions passed because of the women's vote. So when you take a magnifying glass and look at that issue, obviously it means that there are more women who get the minimum wage, Women care about their children, who are some of them in the minimum wage culture, and they think that they may have a lifetime of being in that minimum wage status. And also, women have traditionally been the ones who have voted pocketbook issues because they're the ones who do balance the budgets at home. There's also this other burgeoning group of women voters that are single, and sometimes they're single heads of households. And so the economic issues, the minimum wage, very key to them. If Congress doesn't pay attention, watch out. All those new people will be voted out.
Mm-hmm. I think it was. It's also interesting that another survey, this one was done as a cooperative effort of the folks at the Lifetime Television Network and Red Book Magazine. They also did a similar kind of poll looking at men and women and how they voted. And one of the things that the Lifetime Red Book poll found was that women, and I guess I'm not clear if this was women's perception or men's perception, but generally what they found is that women were perceived as being three times more trustworthy than men, and 4 in 10 voters overall, so I guess that counts both men and women, 4 in 10 voters overall thought that men were more likely to be subject of a scandal.
Right.
And I think that is interesting. And also what that would say is that now this is going to put a lot of pressure on women who are the women in Congress now, particularly on Speaker Pelosi, to really to demonstrate that she is different and that under her leadership that perhaps business as usual won't be business as usual anymore. That's an awful lot of pressure to put on somebody.
Well, it is. I think the other interesting fact is that for a long time in political science venues or where people were talking about women candidates, the anecdotal information was that women are more trustworthy than men, and there have been polls that have evidenced that. People have said they believe women more. They believe that women don't lie. This is the first time that I know of where they've actually codified that in a poll. And, of course, right before the election, there were a lot of scandals, so it was very public knowledge, and there were no photographs of any women getting in trouble. So it was. This may have been historical in the sense of the timing, and it may not last the first time we have a woman who's walking away in handcuffs or seen with Jack Abramoff. It might change.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was also interesting, going back to the Ms. poll, their survey among, when they asked women what were their big issues, and it broke it down according to their party affiliation, that among the Republican women, the number one concern was the Iraq War, but number two was, in fact, corruption in government.
Well, nobody likes their own party to be the one that's in trouble. Mm. I think that the corruption issue for women, when it has to do with politicians, also who they vote for, is that they want somebody who they can trust, and they just want to throw them all out, regardless of who they are, even if they like them.
Let me just introduce quickly our guest again for this hour, for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Susan Scheer. Mm-hmm. She is someone who's been a political activist for a long time now, more than 30 years. She's executive director of this organization called WAND, WAND, which stands for Women's Action for New Directions. She has worked with women candidates at the Institute of Politics and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's also managed campaigns and worked with candidates and elected officials on their media skills, and she's also been a political commentator. She's done work on radio and television in Massachusetts on a variety of subjects, and we're talking here this morning about women in politics, but also women particularly in this last election, the one we had last month, and their voting patterns and what that's likely to say about what Congress will be up to in the next session. Questions, by the way, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I suppose that the big question is indeed, will Congress pay attention to the issues that women voters thought were important? As I've said, the numbers of women in Congress are still relatively small, even though now the Speaker of the House is a woman, Nancy Pelosi. So the big question is, do you really think that will make a difference in the priorities that Congress establishes for itself in the coming session?
Well, of course it remains to be seen, but just this weekend I'm going to a retreat for leaders of women's organizations so that we can coalesce And if we do that and we set up our own requests of Congress and not try to inundate them with a lot of different messages, that will certainly help them make some decisions. But we also do see very clearly that as soon as the election was over, Speaker Pelosi, or Speaker-to-be Pelosi, laid out very clearly that some of the issues that came up in the election were ones that she was going to deal with. And I mentioned the minimum wage, also Social Security, which is high on the list for everyone, but for women in particular, and, of course, issues about Iraq, which was what really tipped this entire election. So she has already stated that she's going to handle some of those issues. Education, however, is a very big concern to women, and a lot of women, especially on the down ballot races, vote on education issues. And it's a very difficult one to tackle at the federal level. So that's one of those areas that remains to be seen, how they're going to handle it. And then I want to call out one of the elephant in the room, and that's the federal budget. The federal budget is out of control, as we all know, primarily because of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also because the Republicans, as was pointed out during this election, were spending, spending, spending. You know, the Democrats are not now the party of tax and spend. The Republicans are the party of don't tax but continue spending. So we have a terrible deficit. In January, we'll have the State of the Union address by the president, and we'll want to know about Iraq, and we'll want to know about the budget. He has to put his budget into play in February, and then Congress gets to respond. How are they going to do that? Women, when they were voting their economic issues, were understanding that the things that they cared about that were making their lives easier were being cut in the budget in favor of being able to pay for a war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So all of the services that the federal government provides have been cut and slashed to the bone. So it's not just about foreign policy, per se, but it's also about where the money is going to go. And this is something that my organization, WAND, Women's Action for New Directions, specifically works on, because our goal has been to get unneeded, unwanted, excessive weapon systems of the budget so that we can pay for domestic programs. And now here we are with an immense deficit, with a budget that does not even include the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And for people to understand this, it would be like having your own household budget where you pay for all your bills, and then you have this huge expense on the side where you have a bulletproof house or a big armed fence around your house that you somehow pay for without any income. So that's where we are right now. And there are, you know, most voters were aware of the budget problems as they were going to the polls. And we're going to be able to find out right away in February how this new Congress is going to address all these spending issues, and the spending issues on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's a tough position for them to be in. And all of these new people who are elected are going to find some of their very early votes very hard ones to take.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure if this is a question that you're in a position to answer, but let me ask it. Obviously, when you talk about elected officials that are most positioned to have a direct effect on people's lives, it in many cases, we're really going to be talking not quite so much about the Congress, but we're going to be talking about state legislatures and local governments and county boards and city councils and the government that's closer to where we all live. That's not saying that what Congress does isn't important. If you take a look at, and we've talked about the numbers of women in Congress, if you take a look at how women are doing running for office on the state and local level, to the extent that you know about that, are they doing better? Are there more women, for example, in state legislatures than there are in the Congress?
There are somewhat more. I mean, there's 23% in state legislatures, and they did a little bit better this year than in the last couple of years. And you're right, you know, all politics is local, so what your state legislature does is incredibly important. But I also want to point out to you that the relationship between the federal budget and the state budgets are very, very close. You know, the state goes for money to get from taxes for people in the state, but they also get money from the federal government for certain programs. And a lot of those have been cut. So the states have had to make up the difference in their own states. For that reason, a lot of legislatures and city councils, for that matter, are paying a lot more attention to the federal budget. In fact, one of the things that WAND, Women's Action for New Directions, is working on is a thing called the Common Sense Budget Act, and we're taking it to city councils, and one of the city councils that is looking at it right now is the Chicago City Council, because they understand that if the federal budget is changed, then there will be more money available at the federal level to spend on environmental cleanup, on homeland security, protect the ports, on education, and that helps your state budget. So there's a very, very close relationship. Now, to your question about how it matters with women, my organization also has a program for women state legislators. So we work with them all over the country. And women state legislators have, as you might imagine, typically they come to the legislature with the kinds of experiences that most women bring to public office, which is from their homes, and many cases being, but not all cases, being mothers and having children in school. So they are very keen on education. They're very interested in health care because they deal with the health care, by and large, in the family. A lot of them are dealing with aging parents and also small kids in school. You know, we're sandwich generation sort of placement for women. So these legislators who are going into state legislatures are bringing that experience with them, and they are looking at the programs with that eye. And when they then find out where they could get more money, which is from the federal government, they begin investigating the federal budget as well. You know, there's the old saying about the bank robber. When they asked him why he robbed banks, he said that's where the money is. So if you want some money to pay for the programs, for the things that you need, and you're a woman looking to pay for education, environment, job training, a future for their children, you're not just going to look for taxes, but you're going to look to the federal government. And that's why I think this next few years in Congress is going to be so key on how Congress deals with the budget and spending on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and how much money we're spending on things like nuclear weapons. Hmm.
We're almost at our midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580. Again, I'd like to introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in, Susan Scher. She is executive director of WAND, that's Women's Action for New Directions, and it's based in Arlington, Massachusetts. It is a national women's group that is concerned primarily with issues of arms control, disarmament, defense spending. She's been involved with WAND for 10 years. She's also been a consultant. She has worked with candidates. She's managed campaigns and trained candidates and worked with elected officials on their media and image presentation. She also was involved in creating and running a program for women candidates at the Institute of Politics in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. We're talking about women in politics, particularly the role that they played in the election last month. Questions, comments, whatever, are certainly welcome. You want to be a part of the conversation, you certainly may. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think probably there would have been a time in recent memory where when one was talking about women and their involvement in politics and women running for office, there would have been people who would have asked questions about the willingness of voters, and I suppose particularly here, male voters, to vote for a woman. Are we, and I suppose that when we get to the point of having a real serious contender as presidential candidate who happens to be a woman, we're going to get back to asking that same question. But I'm wondering whether you think, in fact, we've kind of gotten away from that so that we don't have to ask that question anymore, or would you expect that there would still be significant numbers of Americans who would have some sort of reservation in voting for a woman, particularly if you're talking about the top office?
Well, pollsters do ask that question all the time, and in fact, and maybe it's because Hillary Clinton is mentioned all the time, but since the last time that Lifetime did a poll on this, the number of voters doubled of those who would vote for a woman president. So maybe it's, as I say, it's because somebody, there's somebody out there who they can imagine as president, and that makes a difference. I think that the really interesting thing about this also is that when polling first started, it was women who were reluctant to say that they would vote for a woman for president. And in fact, women are sometimes the harshest critics of other women. And it kind of goes back to the issue that you raised earlier about whether or not there's corruption. Women, when they started running for office, found that they had to meet a higher standard than the men, and that part of that standard was exacted upon them by other women, because those women felt as if the woman who made the breakthrough had to be perfect. You can't make a mistake. So we might feel that way. Women might also feel that way about a woman running for president. But now that Hillary Clinton is there as a model and a possibility, and she's already served and served with distinction, some of that fear of failure may have gone away.
Hmm. I know that for some time now there have been various kinds of organizations that were interested in encouraging women to run that have tried to get people to at least think about the possibility of a woman candidate and a woman president, and did things like, well, who do you think would make a good president? Who would you like to see run, just as a kind of an exercise to get people to think about that, and also, I suppose, to put those names in, to get those names in front of people. And I suppose that we should expect that sometime, one would hope that within our lifetimes, we'll see something like that happen. We will see a woman run, and we will see a woman elected president of the United States. Can you imagine what exactly that would mean? What it would feel like at that point where that actually happens, and will that seem like an earth-shaking thing, or do you think at that point it won't seem like, we'd have to acknowledge that it's significant, an historical kind of event, but that it won't feel as big as maybe we would imagine that it would?
I think the earth will move. I do, and here's why. I heard three National Public Radio women speak just last week, Nina Totenberg, Linda Wertheimer, and Cokie Roberts, at this Ford Hall Forum event that we had here in Boston. And one of the questions, my question, in fact, to them was about what it was like to be a woman journalist and to be a breakthrough, at which they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they had lots to say about that and lots of very interesting stories. But one of the things they also said is it's still not over. But part of they still get criticism, or they see other women getting criticism and maybe more criticism than their male colleagues, and that their male colleagues maybe didn't have to work as hard and a lot of other factors. They also said, however, that the young women coming up as journalists kind of took for granted the path that they were now walking. And so to your point, in that field, it's almost as if the change has taken place. There have been lots of women in public view, in journalism, on the radio and on television now, and that's only been in the last 10 years. So that is a generation of women, though, who have grown up seeing them on television, hearing them on the radio, and getting it that they could do that. And so they are unaware of all of the pressures and problems of previous generations. Now, take that over to the presidency and why I think the earth will move. That puts it in a wholly different platform. It is the leader of the free world. It is someone who operates at an entirely different level with leaders all over the world. It also means that because you're president for 4 years and possibly for eight, a new generation of people born when you are president will grow up believing that a woman can be president. But it also means that many, many generations will look at that possibly with either surprise, awe, or maybe even horror, because it is so, so new. The other thing that it means is that the tone is always set at the top in many, many, many ways. For you and I, we probably remember the first time there was ever an African American in the cabinet, an African-American, as you have in the U.S. Senate. And it was the first time any of those things ever happened, it was a shock. I mean, there was members of Congress, Carol Moseley Braun, the first time she went to the Senate, stories of her, you know, getting in the elevator and having the elevator operator tell her to get off because it's for members only. Mm. And that's just not been so many years ago. So I think that when this does happen, there will be lots and lots of things that will change. There will be the glass ceiling will be shattered, standards will be broken, and if you watch the TV show about a woman president, you'll see that the entire, just the societal aspects of how you deal with the job will crumble. And all those, that's not foreign policy and that's not earth-shattering. It tells you that every single step of the way, things will be different. Mm-hmm. And when things are different, it's shockwaves. Now, is that a bad thing? No. We're absolutely ready for it. As you all in Illinois, you first had Carol Moseley Braun, and now you have Barack Obama without, you know, even a wrinkle. In fact, he's being mentioned as a possible candidate himself. But being the first one to break through means that there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of change. It can be a tsunami or it can be a breath of fresh air.
I wonder, though, if when that happens, and I'm sure it is, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when that happens and we have a woman elected president, whether also that might, in some sense, maybe not so much in a way that we would say, but somewhere inside us we would say, well, now we've done that, and then after that it would go back to being the way that it was, and it might actually be some time between the first woman and the second.
Well, it depends on who's in the pipeline, and this goes back to your question about state legislatures, because the pipeline is if people get into office and they move up. Now, with term limits in some states, you move up or out, because if you want to stay in public life, you have to run for a different office. So I think one of the other things that will happen is that the more women you have as governors or in the Senate or in positions of power, the larger the pool is, the more likely it is that there will be female candidates for president. You know, the White House Project has done studies on this, and years ago when they first did it, one of the first women who made the final cut was Claudia Kennedy, who is a general. And so it was somebody who didn't come out of politics, but who came out of the military. Or it could be a president of a university who makes a name for themselves. I mean, Woodrow Wilson was the president of a university. So at governors, we now have women who are running for governor all over the country, and actually the biggest route to the presidency is through the governorship and not so much through the U.S. Senate. So it really depends on the pool. One of the other interesting things is after this the Iraq War, there are many, many more women who've been in the military and who are moving up the ladder. Many people have said that maybe the first woman president or the second one is going to be somebody who comes from the military.
Now, I think if you look at this in a casual way, and I'm sure that people have actually studied this closely, look at women and their campaigns and men and their campaigns and ask this question, well, are there some significant differences? It would seem that on the surface, nothing to me seems really obvious, but then I'm not an expert in this. So they seem when women are the candidates, they seem that the campaigns can be just as tough, just as bruising, as the same tendency to be negative, if that's what seems to be called for, not seeming shy, not seeming soft-spoken. Having said all that, and I'm curious, because you have worked with women candidates, are there ways in which when they're campaigning, that women, like it or not, have to do things differently?
Yes, but there are no cookie-cutter campaigns. And I think we've seen in just this election that there were several campaigns that were not determined on election day, and the women who were in those runoffs or recounts or whatever, they were didn't give up. They fought back, and they are suing, and they're trying to find every single possible vote that they can. And this probably would have been unheard of 10 years ago. I don't know that there are any statistics on that. On the other hand, I wanted to point out a story about a campaign this year that is really fascinating. And for many of your listeners may not know, but New Hampshire, that has traditionally been the, you know, what they call a red state, turned blue this last election, and they only have two congressional seats. Both of them went Democrat, and one of them was won by a woman. And her campaign was totally non-traditional. It was so non-traditional that she was not endorsed by the Democratic Party during the primary. In fact, they put lots of money into her opposition. No one gave her any chance of winning at all. And she had done her campaign the old-fashioned way. She had started 2 years ago building a grassroots campaign by, you know, going door to door, going to town meetings, learning the issues, listening to people, and doing a very kitchen table campaign, not having a campaign headquarters, not paying for expensive staff or polls or materials, and in fact, raising very little money at all. In fact, the whole idea for her campaign emerged from her book club, and she won. She won, and she just blew everyone out of the water. And when she won, you know, the national press came to her and discovered, lo and behold, that she was smart, sharp, dedicated, focused, and she said the way she won was by listening to people and paying attention to what they cared about, and the man she ran against didn't. So, and that's kind of the traditional sort of campaign that women started doing when they first started running for school committees maybe 30 years ago. So those campaigns can still win.
I guess I still wonder, though, you know, when we've talked about the issues that women seem to be concerned about, whether there still isn't in terms of issues, there isn't still a kind of a genderization of issues. You know, that is somehow that women are always going to be associated with family, with issues that have to do with family and economics, and that men probably are going to be associated with the other kinds of issues, particularly like defense. I mean, does in the way people think about who's best able to deal with what kind of issues, are we having a hard time getting away from? And, you know, maybe that's not necessarily a problem, but do you think we're having a hard time getting away from that idea that there are things that are kind of men's issues and women's issues, and when we look to our leadership, maybe that we're also thinking that there are issues best dealt with by women and issues best dealt with by men?
No. I think what we're finally beginning to see is that all issues are women's issues. It's just that we might be looking at it with a different lens. So, for example, on banking issues. Women might be looking at it from an access point of view. Is it convenient to seniors? Is it convenient for students? You know, are the fees too high? And when you say that it comes from a family perspective, it's just, again, the lens that they're using, and that's what representative government is all about. Now, how that translates into military issues or into weapons issues is almost the same thing. And it doesn't mean that every woman who comes to Congress is a peace person, not at all. You look at Jane Harman from California, and she was tough as nails on the Armed Services Committee, and also very pro-military, and looked at it from a very business-like point of view. What do we need to get the job done? Not from a, you know, kind of anti-war stance. But there are more and more women who are paying attention to this now in particular because, on the one hand, we want security after 9/11. It's very clear what some of the security issues are, and they're homeland security issues, protecting our ports, protecting nuclear power plants, having the hospitals connected so that they can communicate in times of crisis, and having hazardous training and bioweapons training for fire and police. And everyone is concerned about that. At all levels of government, whether you're male or female, and they know the details on it. When it comes to, say, buying weapons systems, all the way back to Patricia Schroeder when she was first on the Armed Services Committee, and literally, and I want this story told, it's really kind of, it's funny and not so funny. When Pat Schroeder from Colorado was first on the Armed Services Committee, and so was Ron Dellums from California, and he was African-American, the chairman of the committee did not want them to be on that committee, and so he gave them literally one seat to sit in. So they were quite actually cheek by jowl sharing a seat on the committee. Now, they served with distinction, and Pat Schroeder, when she ran her aborted campaign for president a long time ago, one of the reasons she was qualified to run is because she had become an expert on the military and armed services. Do I think that they look at it differently? Yes, I think women look at everything differently, which is why it makes the Congress a much richer place if we have both men and women.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Susan Scher. She's been a political activist for more than 30 years. She is the executive director of WAND, W-A-N-D. That's the Women's Action for New Directions. It's based in Arlington, Massachusetts. It's a national women's arms control and disarmament organization, and she's been there at WAND for 10 years. She has been involved in politics in a number of different ways. She created and ran a program for women candidates at the Institute of Politics and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's also managed campaigns and trained candidates. She's currently president of the Ford Hall Forum, which is the longest-running public forum for the presentation of diverse discussion and debate. And she's joining us by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just because you're involved in this organization that's interested in defense issues, arms control, and forth or so forth, not very long ago, I had a conversation with a woman who had written a book looking at what, as far as women's involvement in the military, seems to be the most contentious issue, and that is women, whether or not women should be in combat and whether they should have the opportunity to act to not just in a sort of incidental way, but in a deliberate way be involved in combat, to be in the infantry. It starts when thinking about just how women's increasing involvement in the military may have something to do with how it is we think about how it is we're going to use that military. And this is something I've thought about on and off for a long time, about how when we see the troops go off to fight, how is it that the way maybe we're thinking about this is changed by the fact that it's not just brothers and sons and dads that are going. It's also moms and sisters, our women kids, not just our boys. And I'm sure that this conversation about women in combat isn't going to go away, and women in the military isn't going to go away. Do you think that there are some ways in which our thinking about war and our thinking about where it is we send our troops have changed? Maybe will continue to change because now women are so much a part of it, and even to a greater extent than before, women are also in harm's way.
Well, I can remember a story on National Public Radio back during the Persian Gulf War in 1991, where they interviewed a husband and wife, both of them were in the military, and both of them had to go. And the story was about how they were going to handle their children and who was going to take care of them, and it was a real family story. Now, that war was different because it was considered more of a surgical strike war where our troops were not in harm's way. And, in fact, one of the messages of that war was, you know, the fewer body bags, the better. And maybe that's why the war never really completed its goal. One of the things that came out of that were studies that said the American people don't want to see body bags anymore, whether they're men or women. And so maybe they were more comfortable with women being sent to the Persian Gulf War because there were fewer casualties. Okay, fast forward to where we are in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's true, during the first couple of years of the war, we didn't see so much about who was dying, and it's only been lately that it's been publicized, and there are, you know, pictures of them, and so you can see how many women are the casualties, whether they're dead or hurt, whether they're in service and troops, or whether they're, you know, nurses or doctors or whatever. So I think that the gender issue is maybe second to the larger issue, which is what kind of war do we want to have, that the American people don't want our military to die. You know, we want to have a military because we think we're strong enough to protect ourselves and we want to be able to go to war, but we don't really, really, really want them to die and be hurt. And the gender issue may have been the tipping point for that. Okay, it was bad enough for young men to die, but, oh, now they're young women. So it'll be interesting to see when this war is over, if it's ever over, what kind of analysis there is of what effect that had on the American people's psyche about what kind of a war, if any, they want us to fight. Hmm.
We have 3-4 minutes left here, and suddenly we have a number of callers. I'm not sure what it was we said that suddenly grabbed people, but let's talk
about probably women going to war.
We'll talk about we'll try to get at least a few of them in the time that remains, starting with a caller in a small community not too far away from here, Philo. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not concerned about women in the military. That didn't spark me to call. I guess just a general comment is that I think with the incompetence of the present leadership and the incompetent way they conducted this war, that it would lay to rest the notion that only the Republicans can handle national security issues, whether they're men or women. And I hope that that's the case, because we've always heard, oh, if you want to, you know, people concerned about security, you got to vote for a Republican. Well, they haven't done a very good job in the last few years, especially with this particular president. So that's my thought. And I'll hang off, and you can comment on that or not, whatever.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment. I don't know, Ms. Sherry, you can comment on that if you want.
Well, I agree with that, and I agree that now also we don't say anymore that Republicans are the only ones who don't spend money. In fact, they spend a lot of money. So a couple of myths were shattered in this election and by this administration.
Champagne is next. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. What sparked me is here we're still talking in this country, 2006, about electing a woman president or African-American president or Hispanic, Latino, Asian, anybody but a white man. And we have countries like Britain, Germany, Chile, the Philippines, India, who've all crossed this barrier, at least with respect to women. How do you account for this country being such a laggard in this regard?
I think it's a big country and it's a very diverse country, a lot more diverse than I think we ever thought that it was. And so I think that makes it more difficult for us to have changes. And because we have the form of government that we have, instead of a parliamentary system, which allows for voting in a different way and having more women involved from the beginning, because they have platforms of both men and women that have to be elected from the various parties, and that we just have this two-party system, and we have so much money in politics, and women have had trouble raising money so that they can get out there and get their name known, that those are problems that don't exist in other countries.
Thank you.
All right. Line four is next. This is someone in Chicago. Hello.
Given the volatility in the international situation and the fact that many of the women in the international area, as the previous callers mentioned, have been, like Prime Minister Thatcher, Golda Meir, Gandhi, and the one in Chile and others, and Chancellor in Germany, I don't know that in this country they're ready to endow the woman with the title of Commander-in-Chief, given the fact that they're so volatile these days. And apart from Hillary and others, like previously Elizabeth Vo was being considered to run for president, I don't know that they're ready to turn over the gauntlet to a woman to handle that position.
Well, I think after Condoleezza Rice and Madeleine Albright
I don't know that they're ready to turn it over in terms of a Commander-in-Chief yet.
I don't know. I think that because of Condoleezza Rice and Madeleine Albright, people are getting the notion that women can't handle it, and that we're not going to ask the question that was asked of Geraldine Ferraro, was can you push the button and cause a war? I don't think that question's ever going to come up again. Whether it's in somebody's mind, that may be, but I think to a much lesser extent.
All right. Again, I want to try and get one more. The caller is on a cell phone, line number three. Hello.
Yes, I guess I'm just tail-doving into the last couple of questions, but I frankly don't think that America is ready for a female to be president. And I say that because most of the, and maybe it's my circles, and I travel this country, but most of the time when I hear negative things about females being president, it's females that are making that comment. I'd like your guest to comment on that.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think you did, Michelle, you did earlier say that often women are the harshest critics of other women.
And I think the best answer to that is for as long as there are more and more women running, winning, and succeeding and doing a good job, women will be more comfortable with them. I think the sociologists say that women believe that women who represent them in Congress or wherever they are represent them not just publicly as elected officials, but personally as women, and whatever they do wrong reflects on them. But the more there are and the more they succeed, the easier it will be for women to be more forgiving.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're at the end of the time. I'm sure this is a subject we will get back to on another day. In the meantime, we want to say thanks to our guest, Susan Scher, Executive Director of WAND. That's Women's Action for New Directions. If you're interested in finding out about this group, they have a website, which is www.wand.org. Also, one other organization that came up in the course of the discussion, maybe if people are interested in this idea of women and participating in politics, you can also look at the White House Project. And they are also on the web as well. They're interested in promoting women's involvement in politics at all ages, and I think particularly trying to encourage girls, young women, to think about the idea of running for office. So that's another place you could go. Ms. Scher, we want to say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope we can talk again.
All right.